Ryan's One Night Love Child, and The Generosity of the Dead. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
In the NCAA men's basketball tournament, defending national champion Duke has been eliminated. Fifth seed Arizona routed the Blue Devils 93-77. Coach Mike Krzyzewski says Arizona was on a hot streak, hitting 60% of its three-point shots.
They just got on a real roll. And when you get on a roll, you would have more energy than the other guy who doesn't get on a roll. I don't think it's something our kids did poorly. We had no stop for them.
In addition to Arizona, Connecticut, Florida, and Butler have also advanced to the Elite Eight in the tournament. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Nissan with the 100% electric, no-gas Nissan Leaf. Innovation for the planet, innovation for all. Details at nissanusa.com.
Programs on WILL are made possible with support from Sinfonia de Camera. Sinfonia at Rush Hour. Play it again on Thursday, April 7th at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The program will celebrate music from the silver screen to the small screen with music for the whole family. Information at 333-6280. Support for today's broadcast comes from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign. Along with their dinner menu, tapas is served every evening until 2 a.m. Lunch is also served on Friday from 10:30 to 2:30 and brunch on Saturday and Sunday. Information on menus and wine and beer lists is at RadioMariaRestaurant.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. It's our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. This morning, once again, we're bringing you programs from the Focus archives. In the second hour, we'll have some more of our 30th anniversary archive shows. These are programs that have not been heard in a very long time. We're bringing back to mark the fact that we've been on the air 30 years. That'll be in hour number two. The first hour is also an archive, but it's a bit more recent. It's a show that we first presented in January. So do keep in mind as you listen that this morning we'll not be taking calls. Dwight Eisenhower is not known as one of the country's great presidential orators, yet 50 years ago this month, he gave a speech that has earned a permanent place in our public memory. It was that speech that warned of the influence of the military-industrial complex. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with James Ledbetter. He is editor-in-charge of Reuters.com. He is also the author of a recently published book that takes a look at the meaning of this famous speech, both then and now. The title of his book is Unwarranted Influence, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex. It's published by the Yale University Press. The book's out now if you want to take a look at it. And Mr. Ledbetter, hello.
David?
Yes. Hi.
How are you?
I am fine. How are you?
I'm great.
Good. Thanks very much for being with us. We
My
appreciate
pleasure.
It. So many things we could say about this speech and about the man. I guess one of the things that's kind of striking right up front about the speech is that it was very short. You have the entire text in your book, and it only runs to about 10 pages. And if people want to actually see it, they can go to YouTube and they can watch it. It's not going to take up very much of their time. Clearly, this was something that, particularly sitting in front of the television cameras, this was not something that Eisenhower was comfortable doing.
Yeah, I think Eisenhower was probably never that comfortable with television as a medium. Remember, you know, his was really the first presidency to be around for the growth of television in the United States, and he was a bit older than the average American, and sort of slow to adapt to the realities of TV. But the desire to make an important statement on the way out of two terms in office was very strong. And in fact, he had begun thinking about doing this maybe two and a half years before the speech itself, long before anyone had identified what the topic was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
He had an idea based on Washington's farewell address that it was a good thing to do to leave the nation with something to think about, a bit of collected wisdom after two difficult terms in office.
And he was thinking about the fact that he would be talking to the people who were there at that point, but also he seemed to be thinking about the future. I don't know how to what extent he was thinking about it, but clearly he wanted to leave people with something to think about, not only the people that would be listening to them then, but also after that.
He told his speechwriter, Malcolm Moose, I don't want to make headlines. I want to say something that people will be talking about decades from now. And the fact that we are talking about it 50 years later indicates that he got it right.
The phrase, the military-industrial complex, was not those were not Eisenhower's words. Clearly, he was sympathetic to the theme of the speech. Do we know who it was that came up with those words?
Well, this is a very interesting question. It is largely believed that the phrase military-industrial complex did not exist until Eisenhower uttered it. Now, this is not entirely true. I have found three examples going back to the early 20th century of this phrase in use, but the first two are not in the same sense that Eisenhower intended the term. They refer to a specific part, a geographical part of a country, almost more like a compound than what we think of as a complex, this intermeshing of public and private, of military and business. The third usage, however, comes from an article in Foreign Affairs magazine in 1947. And that is an article about World War II and the role of the economy in winning World War II. And the use there is very much along the lines of what Eisenhower intended. It's not, by the way, it's not meant as any kind of warning in this 1947 usage. It's more descriptive. But I suspect that phrase stuck in somebody's mind and ended up in this speech via one of two speechwriters, either Malcolm Moose or Ralph Williams, the two principal men who worked on the speech. There were many other advisors that saw and commented on drafts, but those were the two men responsible for drafting the speech. So one of them is probably responsible for putting that phrase military-industrial complex onto paper.
Yeah. Although I think that is true, it's important, I think, to make the point that, as you say, there were people who were speechwriters. Presidents have speechwriters, and that a lot of people looked at them. The president's brother apparently looked at a lot of his speeches and did at least some revising for style. But at the end of the day, the president himself went carefully over the speeches. The drafts were presented to him. He scrawled all over them and put down what it was that he thought. So clearly, he had a great deal of input into what the final product was.
Absolutely. And this is an important point, especially for those who are not that familiar with the speech writing process. There's no way that Eisenhower, who cared deeply about the issues that he was speaking about, would allow himself to be used as a vessel for someone else's ideas, especially not on an occasion as important and grand as his leaving the White House. So this is why you have speechwriters, sort of somebody to do the spade work for you that you can then mold into your own ideas. But the goal of an effective speechwriter from the beginning is to try and capture the voice and the thoughts of the person for whom you are writing the speech. So it's already somebody who's making a stab at writing in your voice with your thoughts. And it's quite clear, and I lay this out in Unwarranted Influence in some detail, that these ideas, that the sort of malign influence of military contractors and the people responsible for contracting on the part of the Pentagon, that these ideas were very much in his mind in the final years of his presidency.
Mm-hmm. And also an important point is that those ideas, people had been writing about that and talking about it, their concerns about the political influence that arms manufacturers might have, the question of whether or not arms manufacturers actually are promoting conflict or urging the country to go to war because that's good business for them. These kinds of things people had been talking about for probably a couple of decades at least before Eisenhower gave this speech.
Yes. There are, I think, sort of earlier strands of this thesis that you can find in the United States going back perhaps to even the Civil War. The notion that arms manufacturers either create or prolong or otherwise influence decisions to go to war, to stay at war, to fight war, is something that's been around for a very long time. The other part of it too is that you know, during wartime they jack up their prices, they provide shoddy material, and that in general something about the profit motive in the military undermines American military readiness. And I think the peak of this idea took place in the 1930s. In the mid 1930s, it was then generally known as the Merchants of Death thesis, that the arms manufacturers around the world were responsible for, among other things, coaxing America to join World War One. And this was a very politically explosive idea. The World War One veterans felt, as many American war veterans have throughout our history, that they had gotten a raw deal. The bonuses that they were promised were being deferred. Of course, this was during the middle of the Great Depression, so they needed the bonus, and they were politically a very, very powerful force. And there were a series of hearings done in the Senate led by a Republican named Gerald Nye, that explored this idea of arms merchant exploitation, and we came pretty close to legislating that American military arms would be built by the government. It was considered the least bad idea of the time. Now, getting into World War II basically obliterated all of that discussion. But in the late 1930s, and by the way, Eisenhower was working for the War Policies Commission during this period and came up with a plan for industrial mobilization in case of a world war. Eisenhower was very much involved in those hearings, so I have to believe that he was exposed to all manner of this argument back in the late 1920s and early 1930s.
The guest this morning in this hour of Focus is James Ledbetter, and we're talking about the last speech that Dwight Eisenhower gave as president. That was January 17th, 1961, in which he warned America about the military-industrial complex. And James Ledbetter has written a book about this speech and about the issue. The title of his book is Unwarranted Influence, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex, and it's recently published. It's published by the Yale University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller here to bring into the conversation, someone in Coles County on our toll-free line, line number 4. Hello?
Yes, I remember hearing the speech in January of 1961. I thought it was a great speech, even at the time I heard it. It had been better if General Eisenhower had made the speech years earlier than he did. He, of course, made the speech pretty much as he was leaving out the back door of the White House. But better late than never. I give him credit for that, better late than never. Everything he warned about has come true already. We don't really need to be warned about the military-industrial complex. They already have the massive power that he warned about. In fact, it's so bad that most people don't even think about it. I think the massive power of the military-industrial complex, people don't even think about it. It's just become the norm today. I don't know that that anybody is willing to do anything about it. It appears to me that there's very few people, even liberals, don't talk about it very much publicly. About the only people actually who want to do something about it are some libertarians, but most conservatives, of course, don't want to do anything about it, and even a lot of liberals are scared to death to talk about it. So anyway, everything that General Eisenhower predicted has come true, and it doesn't appear that anybody is serious in doing anything about it.
Well, I appreciate the comments. We'll get some reaction here. Mr. Ledbetter?
Well, I think Carl makes a number of very important points. I think that the one thing I would say about Eisenhower not giving the speech earlier, there was a speech in the very, very beginning of his presidency in April of 1953 known as the Chance for Peace speech, which has a very similar theme. It doesn't exactly take on the idea of a military-industrial complex. I think that that notion developed in Eisenhower's mind and that in the mind of his advisors a little later, but it does very directly take on the overall question of military spending and the consequences of military spending. He talks about we pay for a fighter with a 500,000 bushels of wheat. We could house 8,000 people with the price of one destroyer. And this is a very rare moment in which an American president, who, remember, is the commander-in-chief, and in his case had led had been the supreme commander of Allied forces in World War II, is really kind of taking on the military and saying, why are we spending all this money? What are we ultimately getting? What are we losing by devoting so much of our gross domestic product to the military? Now, I think it's very fair to say that throughout his presidency, he did not follow up on that idea. And it's certainly the case that while he was president, the nuclear arsenal of the United States absolutely ballooned from about 1,000 warheads to about 23,000 warheads by the time he delivers the military-industrial complex speech. But I think you have to give Eisenhower at least credit for, and to get to the caller's second point, for at least raising this issue and raising it in a very public way. It is very hard to find people in Washington where the military-industrial complex is alive and well and profitable, to criticize this, to look at the problems that it creates. Everybody wants to get on the gravy train, and I think the caller makes a very good point that the libertarians, some of them anyway, are one of the few interest groups or sort of political coalitions where you do find this idea still has some traction. And I'm happy to say, although I don't personally consider myself a libertarian, the book has been very well received in those circles. Hmm.
Well, just I have some other callers here. I promise we'll go on to them. Let me follow up, because you write in the book that maybe one of the great mysteries involved in this speech is the question, what exactly, when he talked about unwarranted influence in the military-industrial complex, what exactly he meant. And
right.
I think that there are some people who maybe of a cynical bent who would look at what he said, but also look at the fact that he did not seem to carry that prior to that. He didn't seem to be interested in carrying that idea through. And some people suggest that means that, in fact, he really didn't mean much of anything by it.
Yeah, I think it is certainly possible to look at the gap between what Eisenhower did as president and the values of this speech and say, well, what took you so long? If this is what you felt, you've not only ignored it, but you actually contributed to the problem. And I think there is an element of the speech that is a kind of a confession. Particularly toward the end, he acknowledges that he wishes that the nation could have been more at peace. I think there is an argument that says that there was a bit of a kind of fantasy element in Eisenhower's mind in the later years. You know, one of the things I document in the book is that he was so frustrated with the stagnation of Cold War politics that he began thinking about ways that we could kind of work around the polarization between the United States and the Soviet Union. For example, he considered fairly seriously a massive exchange program of Russian college students and American college students on the order of thousands or tens of thousands per year. This idea was shot down by the State Department and many other advisors, but it was something that he considered. He considered maybe a little less seriously a plebiscite around the world where people could vote in every country. Would they rather live under communism or would they rather live under American capitalism? Again, these things were unlikely to happen, but you can see the motions of a mind that is greatly troubled by the status quo and trying to find a solution for the future. And so there's bound to be, I suppose, an element of hypocrisy or at least a kind of performance gap when someone's thinking that way. But again, I don't think it's very constructive to be too critical of Eisenhower, because at least he was trying to push that envelope, whereas the politics everywhere else, both within his own party and the Democratic Party, was generally spend more on the military. John Kennedy was elected on a platform saying that the United States was behind or about to be behind in its missile race with the Soviet Union, and therefore more had to be spent. So Eisenhower, you know, the only way to kind of to fight this battle was to risk the appearance of hypocrisy.
We have other callers. Lovington is next. This is line one. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
I guess I got a pile on with a story I saw on a show that was called Dangerous Drive. And it was the show that day was, of course, a lot of times going over mountains and stuff. The show that day was riding along with some guys in the military hauling in Iraq. And they were in I don't have any idea what they were hauling, but they're in a semi-like vehicle going down a road that looked like a United States interstate. And the machine they were driving had troubles with overheating, several systems overheating. They were in a machine that had a non-working radio. They couldn't talk to anybody for a long length of time. And, you know, I'm a farmer, and I got some experience with some heavy equipment. To me, you know, I was under the assumption that all this military stuff was super hot, super good, and worked great. But, you know, to me, it was just extremely depressing to keep watching. I just, you know, it's like watching a car wreck slow motion over and over again with all the, I thought, just stupid problems they had that would be completely unacceptable to me in a piece of machinery. That was my comment.
Well, okay. Again, Mr. Ledbetter,
I think this is a great and, if somewhat, depressing comment. And you've heard this in every military conflict the United States has been involved with that I'm aware of. It certainly goes back to the Civil War. Charges of, you know, rifles that don't work. It was a problem in Vietnam. It was a problem in both Iraq wars. And I think that the frustration on a system, forget the individuals and what it might cost in terms of human lives, the frustration on a system-wide basis is lack of accountability. That you know, nobody, as far as I can tell, nobody major ever gets thrown off of the list of military contractors, whether it's Boeing or McDonnell Douglas or Lockheed Martin. You can screw up as many times as possible. You can have vast cost overruns. You can fail to deliver, and you're still up for contracts the next time the budget process comes around. And that's the result of having, you know, just a few major players, partly because they've been allowed to merge, partly because I think their profits are locked in an oligopoly situation. There's no real competition for these things, and I think that builds into the process both shoddy equipment and no cost accountability. And that's a place where you would think the military would want the military industrial complex to be reduced. But again, that doesn't seem to be, at least publicly, on the table for them.
Well, I want to thank the caller. Go to somebody else here. Next up is Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello. I wonder, do you have an opinion on the disparity between what Eisenhower said and what his actions were early in his administration, perhaps through the middle of the administration as well, and the decline in influence of the Dulles brothers?
To an extent, I do. I mean, in Unwarranted Influence, I do take on the idea that John Foster Dulles, who was the very powerful Secretary of State, was often at odds with President Eisenhower, particularly regarding public stances about the Soviet Union. The Chance for Peace speech that I mentioned that he gave in April 1953, which was this sweeping, you know, perhaps not entirely sincere, but nonetheless a kind of groundbreaking speech of a peace offering to the Soviet Union shortly after the death of Stalin. That speech, every time it went through Dulles's hands, it got more and more confrontational. And there's no question that Dulles's personal beliefs and the sort of vehemence of trying to appease the harder wing of the Republican Party had an influence on what Eisenhower could and could not say. Once Dulles died in the late 50s, I think there was a little more opportunity for Eisenhower to let some of his diplomatic ideas flourish and become public. But it's also the case that his frustration with the military was also greater and greater. So it might have happened even if Dulles had stayed alive. I think the other important historical event to remember here is in the fall of 1957, you have both the launch of the Sputnik satellite, which gets everybody scared that the Soviets are now way ahead of the United States. Whether that was true or not, a separate question, but that's what a lot of people felt. And almost simultaneously, the release of something called the Gaither Report, which purported to use CIA data to show that, in fact, the United States had fallen behind the Soviet Union in its nuclear arsenal or was about to fall behind. Eisenhower knew for a fact that that was not true, and he knew this because of the data they'd gathered using the U-2 spy plane, but because that was a top-secret mission, he couldn't reveal his sources, but you can imagine the frustration and the sense of feeling kind of politically ganged up on when both Democrats in Congress and members of the military themselves were using this cynically to say, we need more money, we need more weapons, we need more power.
That's something here, and I want to thank the caller, and we're at our midpoint here, and I've got some others I want to get into. But I just want to underscore that point a little bit, because after the Cold War, it seemed pretty clear that during the Cold War, estimates of Soviet military strength were incorrect. That is, we were overestimating Soviet military strength, and that was used by people who wanted to put more money into defense spending and have more money going into developing new weapon systems and so forth. This was something that Eisenhower himself, as far back as the time that he was president, that early in the Cold War, that's something that he was aware of?
Oh, absolutely. I remember, Eisenhower had more military experience than any president in modern history, and arguably any president in history. And he felt he knew exactly where the sort of hype was in the budget versus the real numbers. He knew what threat escalation looked like. He knew what kind of internecine warfare between the services looked like, where the Air Force dumps on the Army and the Army dumps on the Navy and everybody dumps on the Marines, or however it goes. And he often took issue with his generals, with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, et cetera, about issues of security. And I think one of the motivations for giving the farewell speech and warning about the military-industrial complex was a fear that future presidents, and certainly including the man who was about to occupy the Oval Office, John Kennedy, at that point the youngest president in history, did not have that experience and would be kind of bulldozed by the power of these generals. And so I think he was very aware of the way that threats were inflated, that budgets were inflated, and I think that's one of the motivating factors behind this speech.
Mm. Well, one other thing that has been pointed to as a problem over and over again in the years since is the movement of individuals, people who were career military officers, having had a long career and retired at some kind of senior rank, then being employed as consultants and doing other things by defense contractors.
Yes.
This was something also he was concerned about.
Absolutely. This is something that was discussed and documented by the people who were putting together the military-industrial complex speech. It never really made it into the speech itself. and you know, perhaps because they thought it was an extraneous detail, or perhaps that it was maybe too minor a point to bring up in this context, but it was definitely on their minds, this sort of idea of a revolving door between high-level military officials and the contractors themselves. And in the late 50s, this had been the subject of a lot of inflammatory congressional hearings. There were revelations that, you know, contractors were getting these fabulous weekends in the Bahamas, and, you know, the contractors were paying for it, and the guys in the military were coming back and then signing the checks. There were a number of instances where people were taking early retirement from the military, late 40s, early 50s, and then going directly into these companies. And Congress did actually make some changes in this time period to try and stem that. But I think the power of the revolving door was very much on their minds, and again, was very much on the minds of critics going back to the 1930s at least.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is James Ledbetter. He's editor-in-charge of Reuters.com, and he is the author of a new book, Unwarranted Influence, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex. It's published by Yale University Press, and it does, in fact, deal with this speech. This was Eisenhower's last speech as president, January 17, 1961, so we've just passed the 50th anniversary. And indeed, it was the speech where he warned America about the unwarranted influence of the military-industrial complex. It's quite a short speech. If you'd like to see it, he delivered it for television, and if you have internet access, you can go to YouTube and you can actually watch the speech, listen to the speech. The entire text, it only runs about 10 pages, is also included in James Ledbetter's book. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Champaign County, line 3. Hello?
Hi. This accusation that you referred to about the, you know, American way of war of engineering missile gaps, that was what it was called, I guess, in the Kennedy times. There is more recent one, which is documented by Melvin Goodman, ex-CIA guy, who talks about the Team A and Team B approach, which I guess Gates was in, our current SecDef was involved when Bush was, Bush HW was amplifying the power of the Soviet Union only several years before it collapsed. But I missed the first 10 minutes or so, and I wonder whether you refute the is it apocryphal that he was going to say the military-industrial congressional complex? That's sort of been called the Iron Triangle by analysts of the same, and that was seen as too controversial to include.
I love this question. No, we haven't dealt with it, and the answer is there is no draft of the speech that contains the phrase military-industrial-congressional complex. In fact, what we do have is an internal staff memorandum prior to the first draft of the speech, dated October 31st, 1960, that uses the phrase war-based industrial complex, which is pretty close to what was finally delivered. And so it sort of defies imagination that they would then add congressional or anything else, and only to cut it out again, and that there would be no historical trace of that. So I have to say that I think this is a myth that has been unfortunately passed along by some Eisenhower biographers and picked up quite, you know, plausibly by any number of people. I think it's also important to say that they were certainly thinking about the role of Congress in this Iron Triangle. The opposition was on a day-to-day level to the Eisenhower administration's attempts to impose some kind of budgetary constraint on the military. That was coming from Congress. So it was definitely in their minds, but I don't have any evidence, having reviewed all of the extant drafts of the speech, that was ever actually put into the speech.
So there may have been some discussion about it, but it
That's right. It certainly Congress was on their minds, and you know, soon enough, when the Kennedy administration came in, they had their own battles with Congress. So it's analytically it's absolutely accurate, but in terms of the speech itself, it doesn't seem that they ever intended to use that phrase.
The American Way of War is another book about this whole thing, and it comes out of the Eisenhower Project at an institution on the East Coast. I forget which one, and it has there's a companion film, "The Way We Fight" or something. I forget
why we fight.
Why we fight? Okay.
I think
other callers have mentioned that it's important not to lionize Eisenhower because he didn't do anything about it at the time, and one looks at also Dulles and the complexities of the relationship. I mean, Dulles basically engineered the coup in Guatemala in favor of his cronies and family members who were invested in United Fruit. So there was a lot going on in the Eisenhower period that don't get chronicled that much. But yeah, I guess just the absolute greed and avarice of the military-industrial complex when they don't up-armor Humvees and that sort of thing that we've seen, rather spending it on the most expensive sorts of devices that they then try to rationalize for. All right, that's my rant. Thank you.
Why don't we then just go, well, have another caller here. We'll go right to them in Joliet, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm very interested in what I'm hearing on this program and thoroughly sympathetic with the author. I would just like to add as someone from southern New England now living in Illinois, of course every state is involved with the industrial complex, is one of the things not mentioned here is that the very often emphatically conservative elements of our society who are so anti-Obama, anti-socialism, this is one of the kinds of the fork that we stick into the big meal of the monies being appropriated by the military. This is one of the best examples of pure socialistic intervention of the government in our society, in that these, I'm always in quarrels with somebody with a military background who says, you're a socialist, you're a communist. But when you get right down to it, this is one of the most emphatically socialistic aspects of our society. Not that I don't think we should have a strong military, but if leadership in Washington, D.C., but also in our other congressional elements were clever and honest enough, they could divert those monies into things like infrastructural projects that would also benefit the society. I know that where I come from near the General Dynamics electric boat in Groton, Connecticut, whenever that we've slowed down with these military appropriations, the first ones to scream are not the military, but the people who are living off of these bases saying, I'm going to lose my job. And I think I'd like to hear what the author might have to say on the possibility of diverting those funds to something more infrastructural or whatever that would benefit the society and us just as well. Thank you very much.
All right. You can comment on that any way you like.
Sure. I mean, I think this is a fantastic point. And one of the conclusions that I reached when researching this book is that military spending is sort of, in America, the politically acceptable form of socialism. Or another way of saying it, it brings all of the negative aspects of industrial policy, that is to say, lack of accountability and picking winners and losers and usually ending up with the losers, and sort of none of the positive aspects of industrial policy. It is immensely frustrating to look at the economic literature, which overwhelmingly says that while, of course, military spending creates jobs and adds to the gross domestic product, it is among the most inefficient ways of doing so. Study after study will show you, if you take that same amount of money and invest it, as the caller suggests, in infrastructure or green jobs or any number of science or education projects, that you would get a greater yield in terms of jobs created. But we have the legacy we have. The problem is it's very hard to dismantle the politically powerful machinery that we've built that provides jobs in places like Connecticut, where I also grew up. And so how can you take that away before the other thing that you want to spend it on has yet to be proven? That's an extremely political, difficult political knot to untie. And it's harder still because most of the leaders that we have today are not even interested in saying they want to untie it. They'd rather keep things the way they are, particularly in a time of high unemployment. Who's going to get up and shout that we should stop spending on the weapons that provide jobs for and reasonably high-paying jobs for people out there? So it's a very, very steep hill to try and climb, but I think it does have economics on its side. And if you look closely at the Eisenhower speech, I think it's also true that it has America's best interests on its side.
Now, I probably should have asked this question before now, but just for the record, how much were we spending, how much did the United States spend on defense at the time we're talking about when Eisenhower is preparing to leave office, and how much are we spending now?
Well, that's an interesting yardstick. I think the best way to look at this, of course, is not necessarily in absolute dollars, but in relative dollars to the rest of the economy and the government budget. And on that score, David, the news is not not entirely grim. In the sense that as a percentage of gross domestic product, military spending, when Eisenhower gave the speech, was probably somewhere around 12%. And as a percent of the federal budget, somewhere between 40 and 50%. And both of those numbers are down a bit today. Some of this is political. It depends on what you define as military spending. But the figures that I use would put it as about 6% of gross domestic product. But it is up from where it was prior to September 11th, both in absolute and relative terms. So I think the fear that Eisenhower expressed is still a valid one, but our economy is perhaps less dependent on military spending than it was when Eisenhower gave his speech.
We have about 10 minutes left, maybe a little bit more. Our guest is James Ledbetter. He's editor in charge of Reuters.com, and we're talking about his book, Unwarranted Influence, Dwight Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex. 50 years ago this month, last week, I think, actually, was the actual date, January 17th. That was the date of Eisenhower's last speech as president, and it was a speech in which he warned America about the military-industrial complex. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I do have an email here I want to mention. We have someone who was wondering, is there evidence that Eisenhower was familiar with or influenced by the statements of General Smedley Butler? He was a Marine general and was someone who apparently was kind of controversial. Maybe that's an understatement. Controversial for talking about the problem of war profiteering. About Smedley Butler?
I don't recall coming across the name Smedley Butler. The issue of war profiteering, however, was definitely something Eisenhower was aware of. I track in the book a period that most biographers understandably kind of gloss over. The late 1920s, early 1930s, Eisenhower had a bureaucratic job within the Department of War, but he was responsible for arranging a congressional hearing to deal with charges about war profiteering and to deal with the question of what should the relationship be between government and the military in wartime. I mean, everyone, including Eisenhower, including the military, thought that the way it was handled during World War I was unacceptable. There were tremendous cost overruns. There was tremendous war profiteering. The military couldn't get what it wanted, and it was clear that that was not the way to go forward, but there were any number of options about how to do that, and so one of his tasks was to put together a congressional hearing, and so he was in touch with people with a wide range of views on this subject, and he drafted a memorandum for how to mobilize the economy during a conflict. So if Smedley Butler's views were well aired during that time, I think it's a reasonable bet that Eisenhower would have come across them. Yes.
Well, he apparently did most of his writing and speaking in the 30s.
Okay, well, I'd say the chances are better than 50-50 that Eisenhower came across it. Whether it influenced him or not, I couldn't say, but he was a very rigorous student. He took these assignments very seriously and read widely. So I would imagine that those views crossed his desk at some point. Mm.
Immediately after the speech, was there much reaction? Were people talking about this?
In the immediate aftermath, I think it was a subject of some curiosity. People were trying to wrap their head around what the phrase meant and what it meant. But to be fair, I think the incoming John Kennedy, remember with his inaugural just a few days later, really captured people's imagination more than this speech did. In the couple of years following the speech, you do get a little bit on the margins of society people who are very interested in this. The Port Huron Statement, sort of the founding principles of the Students for Democratic Society, has a whole section on the military-industrial complex. That was 1962. Martin Luther King began to use the phrase military-industrial complex in his speeches. The president of Berkeley, as well as the early protesters in Berkeley, both used the phrase, but it really is the Vietnam War and the escalation of U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War, starting in 65 and sort of culminating in late 60s, early 70s. That was probably the time when the idea had its greatest currency in our society.
Now, we have some other callers. I think we'll have enough time to get them both. We certainly will try. Urbana is next in line, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I read that we have 500, might have been 400, overseas military bases. And that certainly seems excessive and a sign that the corporate military combine is in high gear.
Yeah, I think, if you look at places like Germany and Korea, where we had conflicts in the middle of the century, and then you look at how long we've kept, tens of thousands of troops there with no obvious threat, there's no question that it's excessive, and not born by military need. The question, as always, is how do you cut this thing back? Who has the political will? Who's willing to volunteer for their ox to be gored first? And the way that these decisions are made, it's very difficult to kind of coalesce a group of people around reducing them, and it's relatively easy to coalesce a group of interests around keeping them the same or increasing them, and that is the problem. We don't have a good mechanism for coming up with military needs for what we spend. I mean, there are some really egregious examples of this. The C-130 transport plane being perhaps the most prominent. We produced dozens or hundreds of these planes that the military never asked for. They said they didn't want them, didn't need them, and yet Congress continued to vote appropriations for them presumably because it would help jobs in their district. But that's a sort of crazy process. It's the very kind of combination of private and public interest that Eisenhower was warning against, and I think there's no question it's still with us today.
I want to thank the caller. One more, at least, to Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
Thanks for the program today. I'm calling as a former military person, and I have these conversations often with folks about the true cost of our, what percentage of our budget goes into military spending. I just tuned in right as you were talking about percentages. Back when Eisenhower had the speech, it's my belief that they'll say 1%, which is considerably lower, somewhere around, 17 to 23%. Things I've read put it much higher if you consider all the things that go into military, such as taking care of the veterans after they come home, or upkeep of the Pentagon, certain things like that, as opposed to just what we're spending on weapons and materiel. Could you clarify that a little bit?
Sure. No, I think this is an excellent point, and I guess it's the case in politics that people will use whatever numbers help them make their arguments the best, right? So people who are not particularly interested in seeing military expenditures go down will tend to use the low ball estimate, and they'll just look at, for example, the line item for the Department of Defense. And that is in the somewhere between, 500 million, 500 billion, $700 billion a year. That doesn't include most of the costs for Iraq and Afghanistan. So you've got to tack on hundreds of millions, if not billions more. It doesn't include the interest that we're going to owe on the money we borrowed to pay for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So you have to add on more for that. It doesn't include veterans benefits. It doesn't include as the caller says, the cost of health care for benefits. And depending on kind of how far along you want to take that, I have seen estimates. I don't necessarily endorse them, but I have seen estimates that it's 50% of what we spend, if not more. One thing we need to do as a society, I think, is to kind of come up with an acceptable common ground explanation for what military spending constitutes. Then we can have a discussion about whether it's too much or whether we're getting what we pay for. And then, of course, when you read the Eisenhower farewell address, you really get a deeper sense for what economists would refer to as opportunity costs. What are we not doing because we're spending X amount on the military? What kind of benefit could we have for our society if we put that money to better or really any other use? And that, while much more difficult to put into concrete terms, is the kind of way that I think Eisenhower was encouraging us to think. Mm.
We're just about out of time. We have about a minute. I think, though, that's an interesting note on which to end, that here we have somebody who was a career military man, who was president of the United States, who believed that we needed to have a strong defense, and yet who had real concerns about what that kind of military spending meant for the American economy.
The question for Eisenhower always was not, should we have a military, should we have a strong military? Of course, he believed in both those things. The question for Eisenhower throughout his presidency, and very much for this speech, was keeping things in balance, keeping things in perspective, and not wanting that degree of our society to sort of tip the scales and become too powerful. And he was very concerned that we were headed in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, and unfortunately, we're here at the end of the time, so we're going to have to stop. I would just say once more that if you're interested in reading some thinking about this speech, you can look at the book that we've mentioned, Unwarranted Influence, Dwight Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex. James Ledbetter, our guest, is the author. He's editor-in-charge of Reuters.com. And if you have internet access, you can actually watch the speech. You can go to YouTube and see it. It's really quite short. The text is also included in the book, Unwarranted Influence. And Mr. Ledbetter, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. We first broadcast the show in January. You can listen back to many past Focus programs by going to our website. It's very easy to do. You find out all the material that's there. In fact, a lot of our local production is there, and you can listen anytime you like. It's at willwill.illinois.edu. There's also information there about programs on WILL television and some of the things that we're trying to do in the community. So if you haven't checked it out, do take a look.
Support for today's broadcast comes from 40 North 88 West, presenting the 6th Annual Boneyard Arts Festival, April 7th through 10th. With venues throughout the county, the festival, in conjunction with the local business community, is a celebration of music, dance, arts, culture, and theater. Information on this year's festival is at 40north.org.
Coming up in the next part of Focus, we'll have some more of the programs that we're calling the Deep Archive, something that we've been doing to try to mark the 30th anniversary of the show, going back to some very old programs. They're not on our online archive, and they're shows that have not been heard in a very long time. So coming up in hour number two, you'll hear a conversation, one from 1990 and one from 1991. The first with Rian Eisler. She talked about her book, The Chalice and the Blade, and then in hour two, or the second part of the show, from 1991, this is a talk that I had with Gene Owl, author of the book Clan of the Cave Bear. So that's coming up in hour two. First, though, we'll break as usual, so we'll bring you an update on the markets and news.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at the Chicago Board of Trade, a very promising start to the day in the corn pit. If you are a bull, has in the last hour or so turned to the downside. We'll have to discuss the implications if the market settles lower today with Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics in Lafayette, Indiana, during the closing market report that begins at 2:06 this afternoon Central Time. Let's look at particulars in Kansas City. May wheat is trading 8.55 and a quarter up 2. July 8.65 and 3 quarters up 2. September 8.79 and a half up a quarter. May wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 732 and three quarters, down 6 3/4. July, 768, down 6 3/4. September, 805, down 7 1/2. May corn, 699, down 3 1/2, now down 3 3/4. July, 705 and a half, down 2 1/2. September, 652 and a quarter, down 6.